It's okay now.
Is it okay?
Yeah. That's right.
Okay, today is Wednesday, March 22nd. This is Tape 2, Slide 1, a continuing interview with Stanley Cohen. Okay. Are you all right there?
Yeah.
When we were here a couple weeks ago, it's good to see you again.
It's good to see you again,
thank you. Thank you. I really enjoyed replaying this tape. I heard a lot more than I did the first time through. And where we left off was a comment we made to you. It sounds to me like you were living on the edge, and you have lived on the edge, and you started to talk about some of your adventures, and it was just about that time we had to stop. Can we start there?
Yeah, I don't know everything I told you, so, yeah.
You told us very briefly that you were detained at the border. You didn't specify which border, and I'm waiting to find out how you got out of that scrape.
Well, let me just explain to you my thinking about this type of thing. The type of thing that I think that I'm best at, for the Jewish community, is on the edge, because I have very little fear of anything. Everybody has fears, but I have very little fears about something happening to me or even dying, because I believe if you have a strong cause, that you could die for it. I would say that very few people in the world feel that way. I know they do, and if I say that, people think I'm kidding, but I'm not, because I'm willing to lay myself on the line, not necessarily die, I don't want to die, but I'm willing to lay myself on the line for something I believe. So I've gotten into a lot of things and taken chances in my life that that most people wouldn't do. This whole thing with Cuba, when I first went there, and I may have told you this 4 years ago, everybody would say, you're crazy. Why would you go to a country like that and take that chance? And I think that I had told you that prior to my going, I went in 1982, and I was warned not to come back. Maybe I didn't tell you that story. What happened was that I went in 1982. I found a way to get in, and I've always wanted to go to Cuba. Looking for a Jewish community, I did find it. But I did find 28 prisoners that were being held captive in Cuba. And this was the first flight that went into Cuba. And so 28 Americans were being held captive, but nobody seemed to know about it, except their families, who were allowed to visit for the first time, because this was the first flight into Cuba in 1982. And so I met some people in there, and I met a girl that was willing to visit her boyfriend. She in turn asked me to go to the prison with her to visit them. And I found that these 28 Americans, for various reasons, they were off course. Somewhere, if you fly into Cuban airspace, you've got to report your location every 15 minutes. Well, they didn't have a radio, and they got shot down. There were people maybe somewhere there for drugs. I don't know. I don't know the exact. But there were 28 Americans that were being held captive. I went to the prison, and they were being held in inhumane conditions. 8-foot cell, 4 people to a cell, no bathrooms, a hole in the middle of the ground. They were allowed to have water for the 4 of them 15 minutes a week. No books, no. It was really bad. And so when I came back after that in 1982, I called a friend of mine on the Post Gazette at that point, and I said, do you know that there's 28 Americans being held captive? No. I called the State Department, and they wouldn't talk about it because they said it was classified. Well, that was the same time Iranian that would be held in Iran, so we figured out that they didn't want to get into it, because there was a whole thing about that. So we exposed between her and I, we exposed the fact that there were 28 Americans being held captive. The Americans knew, our people knew. We had no relations with Cuba. So to make a long story short, we got out some of the people. Some of the people were let go. As a matter of fact, when we flew back in the plane, two of the young fellows were shot down, were allowed to come back because the head of the Office of Christians and Jews was on the plane with me, and they gave it to him as a goodwill gesture. shortly thereafter, and you may remember this, Jesse Jackson went down to Cuba, and he subsequently got the rest of the money. But at the same time, I had gone down with a protester, a supporter from Miami, and he called me, and he had known that I had helped to expose this. I mean, it wasn't only me, it was this reporter. And he said to me, I would advise you not to go back to Cuba. Your name is there, and you are, you know, on a list. And you're one of Castro's enemies. And so that was in 1982. Well, I went back in 1996. But I didn't know whether they had my name or not. You know, I didn't know whether I was on a list or I wasn't on a list. So, which could have been, of course, we have no relations with Cuba. And if I would have gone in and I would have been on the list and they would have arrested me, there was very little that the United States could have done to help me. They have what they call an interest section there. You probably heard about it with the Zellion thing. It's like a consulate, but they work through the Swiss embassy both ways. They have one in here too. So when I went there in 1996 for the first time, there was some fear I had of being incarcerated and arrested. But the only thing I felt I had on my side is that they have so little things like computers, and they're starting to get them, but, you know, that I didn't figure that thing would last that long. So it was a big chance, not only from the standpoint of my going, period, you know, I mean, going to a country like that, but the standpoint of the fact that I was supposedly an enemy of the Cuban government.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my experience with that. When I went to Russia visiting refugees, I took, the incident you're talking about, I took supplies, you know, religious supplies and things. In turn, a lot of these people had family in, they had family in Israel, some in the United States, but a lot of them had family in Israel. I visited several families, and they had asked me to take, I had a small tape recorder, and they asked me to take the tape back of the conversation to their family in Israel, because they had no relationship with them. I made a tape, you know, a small microcassette tape, like the one you have. And because, you know, it wasn't something that, well, there was a lot of things on that tape that they certainly, they wouldn't like, particularly Russians, Soviets, I hid the tape in my, the lining of my pants. So we're taking a train to Helsinki from St. Petersburg. And so we had to go through customs on the train. I had taken a mission. It was really a JNF mission. Kurt Klein was with me, and several other people. And actually I had my son with me too. He was one of the youngest people that had traveled that kind of a mission. The purpose was to meet refuseniks and clandestine places, and you had codes, and you had, you couldn't, like for example, couldn't have their names. Like, you had a telephone book that instead of Moscow, it would be Miami, and you put a 305 in front of their number, you call outside the hotel, and you were trained to do all those things, have codes. They really knew what you were doing, but, you know, if they wanted to, and, you know, everybody was always afraid of everything was bugged, but they wanted you to think that, because everywhere you go, there'd be things that looked like bugging devices. Nobody could listen to everybody doing these things. So it was more in everybody's mind, I think. But in any event, I was on the train leaving St. Petersburg, going to Helsinki, and for some reason they body searched me. Instead of just going through my bags, they body searched me, and they found this tape. So I don't know whether I can describe. When they hit that tape, what went through my mind? But several things went through my mind. One was, my life is over, and I just visualized how far it was from here to Siberia. You know, I mean, I don't really. I mean, I thought, oh my God. You know. So they took the tape. And
were
they,
you alone?
No, I was with. There was about six of us in the group,
okay.
Which really worried me more because my son was there too. I mean, you know, I didn't want the whole group to be in trouble, and it's something I probably shouldn't have done, but I did. So they wanted my tape recorder to listen to it. So they took the tape, they locked me in my compartment, held me under like a house arrest, and they held the train, and they listened to the tape, and they came back with a KGB agent, and they said that, you know, we've listened to the tape, and we want you to sign the statement. And I said, well, I think it's in Russian. And I read it. They said, well, it says that you're carrying anti-Soviet material. And I said, what does that mean? I said, well, what it means is that that you'll have to give it to us. Now, I didn't know what else it meant. I didn't know whether, you know, who knows. I didn't even know what I was. So I said, well, I can't sign it. I can't read it. Because I didn't know how long I could go without signing it. You know, I mean, I just said I wouldn't sign it. So they had a meeting between the KGB agent and the authorities. And they detained me about 2 or 3 hours. And then they decided that they would take the tape and release me. The next thing I worried about was the people that were on the tape, because, you know, they had certain ways of tracing the distant conversations, and you know, the Jews are, they could tell. So I went and filed a complaint in Helsinki court. And I didn't care about the tape, obviously. I just cared about, I better make some noise. When I got back, because I was really on my way back, I called some of the inspector's office, and he filed a complaint also. This was just to call attention. And the Russian government finally said that they would give the tape back to me. I didn't really care about the tape, but they would give it back, but I had to go to Russia to get it. So there was no way I was going to Russia to get the tape. I didn't care about the tape, but I think I caused enough diffusion that these people were not severely harassed. That was the idea. That was my experience there. The only question. That's pretty much what happened. It was very frightening because my son was there. I mean,
sure.
I had no idea. You know, every minute seemed like an hour. Every hour seemed like a week. And but it was something I did. Something that probably, if I was by myself, I probably would have done it again. You know, but I wouldn't have done it risking anybody else.
Right. That's enough to clear your sinuses.
Right. Another experience I had was that I had gone to Israel also on a JNF mission. Decided, I was with another friend, his name is Myron Watson, and we decided to go take an excursion to Greece, to Athens. So we went to Athens. We were going to take this short cruise, you know, like a couple of day cruise. So it was like a package that we took from Israel to Athens, and then someone took us up to the airport, and we had this couple of day cruise, and it was part of the package, and it was on a ship called the, there's two ships in this one. I'll give it to you. But, so we were to go on this one ship. City of Poros, this one ship. City of Poros, P-O-R-O-S. And so this was on a Saturday morning. He was supposed to call us Sunday before 12, and we were to tell him when we were going to go, because we weren't sure when we were going, Monday or Tuesday. So this guy never called, and it got to be in the afternoon, and so we decided that we'd make arrangements through the concierge. So we went there, and he said, don't go on that ship. There's a better ship for you to go on. And he said, because he didn't know from one ship to the other, so we decided that we would take that ship. In the morning, there was something on the news, you know, it's the most these hotels you get CNN. There was something on the news about there was an explosion down at the boat dock. think anything about it. And so we went down, we caught our boat, we started to go out on the boat. And we're following this boat that, we're not really following it, but they're in front of us, the boat that we were supposed to be on. We get out to sea, and then maybe a mile ahead of us, and there was a huge explosion, gunfire, and we see the smoke is coming out of this other ship. So our ship is the closest ship to it. We go towards this ship, and what had happened is the terrorists were taking over this ship, trying to take over the ship. And what happened is earlier in the morning they had these explosives, and about three of them blew themselves up. There were six of them. And so there were three left. And they were Iranians who were trying to get, there were some Iranians being held in Israel. And they were trying to make a statement in Greece, I guess, because it was easier to make a statement, security was there, trying to make a statement in Greece. And what they had done is they had tried to threw grenades under the ship, the other ship, and killed, there was 13 people killed. They were trying to get on the ship to take over the ship and hold hostages. Now, we came and there were people dead and it was a sight. But for the grace of God, we could have been on the ship. Now, there were two things could have happened. First of all, we could have got killed. Secondly, they would have got on that ship. These people were, this was about Israel. There were no other Americans on that ship. One, we were an American. Two, we were Jewish. We would have been, obviously, I don't even think I have to rationalize that, but we would have been the ones that they would have gone after. I would have thrown my passport away. 13 people were killed.
Close call.
Well, yeah. I mean, I wasn't on the ship, but it was a close call because I was supposed to be on that ship. We were supposed to be on that ship. And, you know, it's another situation that makes you think. Another situation was, and this really wasn't a Jewish situation, but, well, that wasn't a Jewish, well, it was a Jewish situation, I think, because it could have been a, another situation was is that, I am very adventurous, you know, so I had wanted to go to Venezuela, and there was a cruise to Venezuela. One of the stops was Venezuela, so I took that purposely to go to Venezuela because I didn't particularly want to go just to Venezuela, but there was a stop on the boat that went to Venezuela, so I decided to go, and I'm married to my girlfriend at that time, and we got to Venezuela, and I usually don't take a tour, you know, like off the ship, I usually go on my own, but they say that the Caracas is really dangerous all the time, they say it's better to, and the boat was like 30 miles from Caracas, so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't so easy. So I said, fine, we'll take the boat. We'll take the... So I, in the morning, you meet down at the restaurant, and you're down there, and we met at the restaurant at like 7:30, and they said, we are not going into that. There's some problems in Caracas. That's how it's exactly what they want. And the only thing you can do is you can go off the boat, but you can't, we're not going to be able to go. So I'm really upset. You know, this is the main reason that I went to on this particular cruise to begin with. I get off the boat, and there was a young fellow that was in the army that was married to a girl from South America, who I, you know, became a little friendly, a young fellow. And there was a woman came on, and she was from Venezuela, and I said, I want to go into Caracas, is there someone that'll take me? I didn't really know what was going on yet. She said, well, they're having a lot of trouble. What was going on was there was a coup. They're trying to, the Air Force was trying to take over the airport and also the country. So it was a coup. And she said, well, see, so she comes up with this guy that will take us in. And said, if you can't get past the stop point, there may be a stop point. If not, he'll just bring you back. So I went to this, I don't speak Spanish well, or I speak a little better than I did then, but when I went to this soldier, this guy in the army, I said, he was at his honeymoon with this young girl, with his wife, and she was Spanish, and I said, he dealt with us because the guy didn't speak any English. And she said, they said, fine. I said, I'll pay for the trip. And so we the four of the five of us, the driver and the four of us, start driving, and we hit a, nobody on the highway, we hit a checkpoint. We get into Caracas, which is about 30 miles, and we see what's going on. They're leaving the stores. There's a full-fledged coup. Gunfire, tanks, I mean, it was, so, and they're looting, you know, they're looting the stores, and they're doing everything you see in a thing. I said, let's get to the center of town and see if we, you know, see if we can figure out what to do. Go to the center of town, where we thought was the center of town, and I said, let's get out of the car, there's gunfire. I said, look, if we get out of the car and there's a shot, just fall to the ground. I really didn't think that was going to happen, but it just came out of my mouth, you know, I guess it was in the movie. It seems like the thing to say. Get out of the car, and there's immediate gunfire coming from there, so you don't know where it's coming from. You know, when you hear gunfire, especially, who has a frame of reference for a situation like that? So we hit the ground, crawl back into the car, and we get to where we think is a safe place. There's nothing open, you know, to see, because they're having a revelation. So we said, we better go back to the boat. Now, we had come the regular highway. So the guy looks at his gas. We don't have enough gas to get back. You know, he needed to get gas. He didn't, you know, I mean, at the time, he knew he could get gas. So we're riding around the city with gunfire. There were 60 people killed that day in that particular incident. We're riding around with, so we finally find a gas station that's open. We pull into the gas station. And we were in an open area, and there was gunfire coming from a lot. You know, so there was a bridge near this thing, and we got up against the stone button of the bridge, so the firing would hit the bridge. We pulled up the fire, and then we started trying to go back, and then went down one street. Tanks coming down the street, so they're back up. We went back to where we were going to go back to, and they said, you can't go, the road's blocked off. So how are we going to get back? They said, yeah. Finally, they say, well, there is a way to get back. Now, this guy was from this other place and comes into Caracas all the time. He didn't know this way. He said, over the mountain. So I said, well, we better go over the mountain. For no other reason, we can get to safety. We can be in a safe place out of the city because there's gunfire, tanks, reconnaissance planes. I mean, it's just like it was like a movie. Because most of this stuff is like a movie. So we start over this mountain. We go way up, and I said, thank God it's light. And just then, we're so high up that we hit the clouds. And the road is like that wide. If a car was coming up, there's no way for two cars to pass. Fortunately, I guess there wasn't anybody interested in the city. Cars making all kinds of noise, you know, shaking, making all kinds of praying. And I could see we were going the right way because I could see the other highway and the ocean. And it took us about 2 hours. In the meantime, we had to get back to the ship because the ship was going to leave at 4 o'clock. We get to the finally. Get to the bottom half. I mean, I'm giving the fast version of this ride. We could have gone over the mountain. Didn't know what was the matter with the car. Got to the bottom and saw that the axle was coming off. You know, the tire could have come off. There wasn't really room for any too much movement. So we had to leave the car there and walk to, we were back in, near that city, and walked to a place where there was a friend of his. Now, I was so thankful to be back, I didn't care if we missed the ship or not, but it was getting tight. we go back and the friend isn't calling, but the car doesn't have a front gear. So it's probably ride backwards all the way to the ship. And that was my day in Caracas. The only thing, again, I promised myself after that incident, that I would never involve anybody else in one of my things. And I really haven't. Because it was one thing to risk my life, because I knew what I was doing. You know, I knew that I was taking a risk. But to risk those other people was just the wrong thing to do. So I swore after that that I would never, if I was going to do something like that. And I've done things since then. I mean, I was due to go to, I may have told you, you know, I'm vice chairman of Brothers Brother Organization. Mm-hmm. And I was due to, they asked me to go to Kosovo, if I may have told you that. They asked me if I was interested in going to Albania and then into Kosovo at the time of the war last year. Mm-hmm. And I said I would go.
What did they want you to go for? What would have been
They wanted me to go because of my experience with humanitarianism, because that's what they did. They were taking supplies and things, and they felt that I could be of some help as a layperson. They really wanted to take me as a layperson to observe what was going on. Because I am, you know, I'm vice chairman of that group. And I should go on some of their trips anyway, you know. So I was all set to go, but I don't know whether you... they had a whole thing on it on Channel 11. Michael Rosen did a whole thing on that trip. And he was going. He and Lou Kingston, which is the president, Mike Rosen, and there's really only three or four of them. There's nobody else going from Brothers Brother. But at the time, I was going on a Cuba mission, and we were trying to get this Cuba mission ready, and I said, I'll go, but they were going, they were going to go fly to Rome, then take a train from Rome to the Adriatic, take a boat across the Adriatic to Albania, then take a truck from Albania to the place in Albania, the city of Albania. And I said, they were still flying into, you could get a flight into Albania. The only problem with that was that they would be shut down. You know, it was dangerous, very dangerous. It was Albanian Air. That's the only airline that was flying in, Albanian Airline. So I said, I would go that way. I'm not going to go this way. And then I got to come back that way. And I couldn't, it wasn't the time so much as, you know, come back and it's going to take you 2 weeks to get yourself adjusted to such a rigorous trip. I wanted to go. So I got clearance from the State Department, and I got all my papers, and I got everything, and I had my airline flights, and then probably luckily for me, they canceled all flights into Albania, Tirana, Albania. So I couldn't get there. They kept canceling flights. I had five different ways to get in, and they kept canceling them. And then they canceled all flights in because they were afraid they were going to shut down. I wasn't too worried about that. I was just more... didn't want to go that other way, you know, going to, it was a rigorous trip, you know, and if I could have flown in, now, in retrospect, I probably would have done it, if I would have known that was the only way in at the time, but they left a little before me, and I figured I'd catch up with them. I was asked to go recently, see, they take care of disasters, so they just went to Venezuela, and they asked me to go to Venezuela with them, which I also would have done, you know, if they had this, mudslide.
Right.
I would have gone, except that I, you know, I was under this, and I just couldn't afford the time. But I will go probably on other missions with them. Disasters, you know, they did Turkey, they did Albania, they did Venezuela, Nicaragua. Anytime there's a disaster, they do it. So I probably will start going through some of these disasters.
What are you going to say?
No, that's pretty much what I'm saying. So, these these things that I'm telling you are things that, you know, a lot of what I got myself into, it wasn't by accident, but I went, that I forced myself into going into under blockers. I mean, I shouldn't have done it probably, but personally, I wanted to do it. I promised myself that I wouldn't let other people be exposed, because I have the mentality, I think, to know that it's dangerous. Most people don't have the frame of reference to, you know, who has a frame of reference for walking out and gunfire coming up the street? I don't necessarily have a frame of reference, but I knew that it was a possibility. This girl I was with, she thought she was watching CNN. You know, she didn't really understand the full extent of people getting killed. You know, people get killed with bullets. That's what we're going through now. So that was that was some experiences that I had between Cuba, my first experience with Cuba, and so on. I always felt that the shortest distance between two points is not necessarily a straight line. That I kind of like to do things the way I think they should be done, because I know by thinking from here to here that I'm